Hello, this is another one of the Triumph Tape series, and in this tape we will be dealing with the subject of diabetes. We will not be able to cover all of the aspects of diabetes, but we will cover some very vital ones, and particularly on this tape we will be discussing diabetes type 2, or what's known as the elderly onset type, and its relationship to insulin resistance. Diabetes mellitus is the type of disease associated with blood sugars and the pancreas, and it's a condition in which the body does not properly use the energy from the food you eat. And it's described generally in two types. The first is type 1, which is known as juvenile diabetes, occurring in the young people, and here the body produces little or no insulin. Less than 20% of people have this type of diabetes. Juvenile diabetes usually occurs in people under 40 years of age, and the onset is frequently very rapid with very severe symptoms. Type 2, or the maturity onset of diabetes, is associated with a body that still produces insulin, but the body's unable to use it because of insulin resistance. More than 80% of people with diabetes have this type 2. Type 2 diabetes has an onset that's usually slow and can take years to manifest, all the while putting the individual at serious risk while he or she is not aware of the fact that they have the disease. Unfortunately, in type 2 diabetes, the symptoms are often mild or absent, so that half of all Canadians with this form of diabetes do not even know they have it. It is estimated that by the year 2020, there will be approximately 250 million, or 250 million people, affected by type 2 diabetes, or the elderly onset diabetes. In Canada, the current prevalence is expected to double by that date. And as we indicated before, insulin resistance plays a major role in the development and progression of this elderly onset form of the disease. Insulin resistance for up to 20 years will be present before the onset of direct diabetes of this type. As insulin resistance develops, the body has been designed to pick this factor up, and as a consequence, it says, okay, I'm going to overcome this resistance, and it does so by having an increased insulin present. As the resistance increases, so does the insulin. So the individual does not have diabetes because he's getting more insulin to overcome the insulin resistance. However, there comes a time, as we said, approximately 20 years down the road, up to as much as 30 years in some patients, where the insulin resistance has continued to develop beyond the ability of the body to increase the insulin supply. And as a consequence, now the body is not able to handle the blood sugar, and the blood sugars start to rise. The reason they rise is quite simple. Insulin is required to open up the cells of your body, and so the blood sugar, or the sugar in the blood, enters the cells as a result of the action of insulin. And when it enters the cells, of course, this takes it out of the bloodstream. So the bloodstream blood sugars are lower. If, however, you have too much insulin resistance, the cells do not open, the insulin has been resisted, and because the cells don't open to take in the glucose, then the blood sugar or glucose now slowly starts to increase in the bloodstream. The fuel that your cells require is that glucose, or the sugar in the blood. and it's produced by the digestive system from the foods you eat. And the hormone called insulin that we've already referred to is produced by microscopic clumps of cells in the pancreas. And it's released into the bloodstream from these clumps and aids in moving the blood sugar from the bloodstream into our body cells as already described. Any glucose left over will show up in the urine. And if a lot is present, then we realize that something has happened. The glucose has not entered the cell sufficiently. And this is why urine tests are used. When blood sugar levels are chronically too high, which we call hyperglycemia, which means hyper above, and glyceme is the word for sugar, and emia, the word for blood, it means just high blood sugar, they can cause various types of injury to our organs and nerves, regardless of which type of diabetes one may have, namely the juvenile type or the elderly onset type. There are numerous estimates as to how many people have diabetes, but one of the ones fairly recently used, where in relationship to Canadians, points out that about 1 out of 20 Canadians have diabetes. And this disease is the third leading cause of death from coma, stroke, kidney failure, etc. Many studies also indicate that poorly controlled diabetes shortens your life expectancy by, get this, 1/3. Now, again, the Canadian Diabetic Association recently has stated that over 750,000 Canadians have diabetes and do not even know it. And cardiovascular death is the leading cause of death in diabetics. 50% of amputated legs in Canada are due to the condition of diabetes. This is from a report on prosthetics. In all causes of death, diabetes in Canada rates number 7 now. There's not too much good about this disease, particularly when one knows of many, many patients who've had to have their legs amputated to save their lives. Presently in Canada, there's a leg being amputated almost in every single major city throughout the whole of the country in every major hospital. In 1993, the World Health Organization estimated that 11.5 million people had insulin-dependent diabetes. They also estimated that 98.9 million with non-insulin dependent diabetes were in existence. In the United States, it's been found that this is a very expensive disease. Cost for diabetic care in 1992 was more than $90 billion, that's spelled with a B, dollars. In Canada, the estimate was that up to $6 billion in that same year. In November the 20th, the year 2001, the Medical Post had a significant article on diabetes in which they quote that diabetes may affect 10% of the Canadian population today, and half of the cases are undiagnosed. As we've indicated before, this is a serious disease because insulin resistance, which can occur, as we described earlier, may be present for many years before it overrules or overrides the high insulin levels that result in an attempt to overcome it. But in those years or decades during which time this is occurring, the risks of mortality or death on morbidity or serious illnesses are greatly increased. In the United Kingdom, it has been found that a 1% decrease, and what doctors call hemoglobin A1C, which is a specific test that we use. It's a blood test, and it that determines whether a person's blood sugar control has been effective. And it's a way we use to find out whether our diabetics are cheating or not. But we have known and have seen in this particular study that each 1% decrease in that hemoglobin A1C reduces diabetic-related death, get this, by 21%. It will reduce heart attacks by 14%. This is only a 1% decrease we're talking about in the hemoglobin A1C. It'll reduce peripheral vascular disease, such as they have in their legs, by 43%. This microvascular disease that occurs throughout various organs in the body is reduced by 37%, and the need for cataract extraction is reduced by 19%. This means that the slightest bit of control that one does for their diabetes has a tremendous advantage. This was all data taken from the United Kingdom Prospective Diabetic Study Group 11, Biochemical Risk Factors in Type 2 Diabetic Subjects at Diagnosis Compared with Age-Matched Normal Subjects, and it's found in Diabetic Medicine 1994. Now, since we've already covered the fact that more than 80% of diabetics are the type 2 or the adult onset, and since we've also indicated that this results primarily as a result of insulin resistance, let's now find out what insulin resistance is and how it's measured, and also what we're going to do about it. As you know, insulin is a hormone which is produced by those little islet cells in the pancreas for the regulation of energy in your body. Insulin also decreases the production of glucose by the liver, and it also suppresses the release of specific fatty acids from your fat tissue by inhibiting what is called lipolysis. Now, what in the world is lipolysis? Lipolysis comes from two Greek words put together, lipo meaning fat, and lysis meaning to loose or dissolve. And so we discover that insulin inhibits or tends to put a stop to the body's ability to use up fat. As a consequence, people with diabetes can tend to put weight on because their body now cannot break down fats the way they used to. As we noted before, as your resistance to insulin goes up, the body attempts to compensate by producing more insulin. And finally, it can't compensate enough. The insulin resistance, therefore, is much higher than you need for health. And now that the insulin resistance is so high, the insulin that is present isn't enough to open the cells in the body and allow the blood sugar to drop down so the blood sugar stays up in your bloodstream. When this high insulin level that is compensating for the insulin resistance exists, there's an increase in your triglycerides. Those are the biggest fats in your bloodstream. Unfortunately, too, it decreases the good cholesterol in your body. It increases your blood pressure, increases what's known as central obesity, and that's just a very polite name for beer belly. It also increases your microalbuminuria, which is simply a means of saying that it increases the amount of albumin in your urine. And you also get an increase of urate in your urine. Well, the risk for coronary artery disease goes up, and it's sad to realize that the number of cases of diabetes and this type of problem is predicted to grow to epidemic proportions. As we noted before, as insulin resistance goes up, there's a compensatory increase in insulin. And in the Paris prospective study looked at more than 7,000 middle-aged men, found at a 10-year follow-up that this elevated fasting insulin was a significant independent risk factor for coronary artery disease. I might note here too that the Framington offspring study showed that elevated levels of fasting insulin were associated with impaired fibrinolysis. Well, what does that mean? That means the breakdown of fibrin. And it was associated with an increase or a tendency of the body to produce clots in both diabetic and the non-diabetic subjects. So as one of my bunny trails, I might say this, that all cancer masses in the body cover themselves with our fibrin, so that when our T killer cells come to the come to the cancer mass, they detect this fibrin coat. And they look at it and sense it and say, okay, that's us, and they move away. What we're telling you now is that according to this Framington offspring study, it shows that there's an impaired ability for the body to pull this fibrin down in the individual that has a high fasting insulin level. Which means that if you are a diabetic with cancer, you're in a much worse condition than the non-diabetic with cancer. We, of course, use special enzymes to put tears in the fibrin coat so the T cells can look in the tears and say, oh my goodness, there's a wolf in sheep's clothing in here, and immediately get a message, and they send the message to other T killer cells. They come and they discover there's tears in the coat, and they immediately start to fight the wolf in the sheep's clothing. It should be noted here that the nationality of the individual or his ethnic background is very important. When it comes to diabetes, some of the factors that we normally assume we discover are different when it comes to certain ethnic backgrounds. For example, the diabetic African American, the Hispanic population, and the aboriginals in our country have serum cholesterols of the good type that tends to be higher, and triglycerides which tend to be lower. However, in the case of the African American, his blood pressure tends to be much higher, and it accounts for the propensity or the increase of cerebrovascular events or strokes in these people. Again, with hyperinsulinemia, we find that there's an increase in triglycerides, the biggest fats in the bloodstream. There's a decrease in the good cholesterol, tends to be an increase in everybody in high blood pressure, although higher in the African American. And there's central obesity. Remember, we told you that if your insulins were up, you weren't breaking down your fat cells as much. So as a consequence, you store fat. There are three major factors that are known today that are associated with insulin resistance. One is called tissue necrosis factor alpha. The second one is called leptins. And the third one is called resistin. And these are all secreted by fat cells. And under specific circumstances, each one of these three has been shown to interfere with the insulin able to signal the cell to open up. The tissue necrosis factor alpha is found to increase considerably and is elevated in obesity. It is still being researched, and the researchers are admitting that it is quite a complex factor to understand and to even investigate. Leptins are circulating hormones with profound effects on how much you feel you want to eat, or in other words, whether you feel satisfied after you've eaten, so that unlike some of my children and grandchildren, you will stop somewhere along the route in a meal. It's also important for energy balance and what they call neuroendocrine function, which simply means the ability of the glandular materials and the nerve supplies to them to actually be working together. Again, the majority of obese people have high levels of leptin. At present, not too much is known about resistin other than the fact that it does interfere with insulin signaling. Well, how do we diagnose this resistant problem if it's a major factor in the developing of this 80% of diabetes? Well, one of the first things we do is do an abdominal obesity test with a cloth tape, and it's called waist circumference. Over 102 centimeters in men, or over 88 centimeters in women, is one of the factors that would put a star down for being overweight or obese in terms of insulin resistance. Then, particularly a low HDL, and then elevated triglycerides, high blood pressure over 130, over 85, albumin in the urine, a sedentary lifestyle, poor diet, low birth weight, of course having an elevated blood sugar, the individual's age, because the risks increase with age, a family history of diabetes, or of having had a premature heart problem, such as early heart attacks, and then whether you're an Aboriginal, Black, or Hispanic background. Again, we want to go over the risks of these findings, which if we found that they were all positive, of course, this gives us a good basis for a diagnosis of insulin resistance and the consequences that are going to result are rather grave. Insulin resistance brings with it some grave consequences, such as a 300% increase in the risk of coronary heart disease and stroke, and a 600% increase in your chances of dying when you do have a heart attack. Of course, the microalbuminuria is an independent risk factor for cardiovascular death. Insulin resistance is a great factor for cardiovascular disease and is as great as is found for smokers. And when they inhale that on the end of that fire nipple, what happens, whether they smoked for 50 years or 50 seconds, is that the coronary arteries supplying the blood to the heart muscle itself go into spasm and cramp down. Many of my patients were quite upset when the lab girls were told that if they ever saw my patients coming in and dubbing their cigarettes in the ashtray in the waiting room, that they were to stay waiting there for a good half hour prior to having their ECGs done. Because their smoking was sufficient to cramp down the diameter on the coronary arteries, in which case what we know as the ST segment on the ECG curve would start to drop. And we looked at the drop, we'd say, uh-oh, they may be about to have a heart attack. So we didn't want to have this man-produced evidence. We wanted to have what the body was like without smoking. But it still gave us the opportunity to tell these people that suck fire nipples that they are really risking their life in terms of their ticker or their heart. Well, another risk is that they have enhanced ability to form thrombi or blood clots. This itself increases the risk of heart attack and stroke. Incidentally, obesity causes certain tissues in the body, such as muscle and liver, to be far less sensitive to insulin. And I might also say that this insulin resistance includes a much increased ability to form clots and also to form arteriosclerosis in your blood vessels. I'm not certain whether you've heard that the waist circumference of more than 100 centimeters is a very good predictive factor for cardiovascular mortality or death. You'll find that, if you wish to read it, in Diabetes 1998 December issue. Well, let's see what we can do about some of this. First of all, we want to reduce the underlying causes such as obesity and the absence of physical activity. Here, of course, 30 minutes of exercise at least 5 times a week, and the exercise doesn't have to be Olympic quality. Even a good walk for 30 minutes 5 times a week is an excellent exercise and can produce tremendous benefits for a diabetic. For one thing, they'll have legs to walk on an awful lot longer. Then we treat obesity. And very simply, this can be done, although there are some things that work quite well. One of them is if you get a mercury thermometer and shake it down the night before. For women still having periods, they can only do this test the first 2 days of their flow. Anyone else can do it any two days in a row. And they shake the thermometer down the night before and they put it on their bed table. When they wake up in the morning, they take that thermometer while they're still in bed, put it under their armpit, and they keep it there for 10 minutes by the clock. They take the 2 readings. In Fahrenheit degrees, if you don't get up to a 97 degrees, the indication is that you do need thyroid help. Thyroid help, of course, covers the subject of hypothyroidism, which is not the subject of this tape, but it would let you know that you do need thyroid help. And I will make this comment here, and that is that when the doctor checks for your thyroid levels, he checks the levels in the bloodstream. This thermometer test is saying how effective the thyroid you have is in terms of your cell's utilization of the thyroid. No use having a good level of it if your body cells are not handling it well. And of course that comes into another subject and involves a lot of blocking agents that you have to get rid of, many of which come from certain lifestyles. More of this can be found in another tape on hypothyroidism. One of the factors that we have to keep in mind is high blood pressure, and that of course can also in the majority of cases be handled without drugs. One of the problems with antihypertensives for the diabetic is that while it controls or may temporarily control, and by temporary I may mean up for a fair number of months, may temporarily control that blood pressure, they worsen the blood fats so that you've corrected their blood pressure temporarily and you've increased the high fat level in their bloodstream, so you've set them up for heart attack anyway. In case you are thinking that diabetes of the elderly onset type, which involves 80%, as we said before, more than 80% of the diabetic cases, is not too much to worry about, here's a statistic that should really get your attention. Type 2 diabetic patients with heart disease have a mortality of approximately 50%, 1 out of 2, 8 years after they're discovered. In reading much of the recent literature on the treatment of diabetics, We notice that to combat the insulin resistance, there's a real move being reported in the medical journals and in the research literature and picked up by the diabetic specialists to utilize drugs to combat the insulin resistance. In addition, since they have found that insulin resistance is noted to be associated with some abnormality of genes, gene modification is also in the research facilities in our universities and so on to handle this matter of diabetes. It's important for this speaker to note that rather than the extensive lifestyle and dietary changes that should be involved, that they are pushing this form of chemical and actually what you are by gene modification approach to solve the problem. We really need more nutritional research, and we'll indicate some of this as we go along in this and another tape concerning diabetes. Presently, it's noted if you read the research journals and the medical journals that there's not a few researchers that are attempting to solve the insulin resistant problem with experimental drugs and gene therapy. To utilize drugs to combat insulin resistance and adjust the genes in an individual or apply genetic treatment, as it were, to solve this problem is like having a good engine to start with, and when it acts up due to a lower grade and adulterated gas and oils, having the mechanic come along, redesign the engine, which is equivalent to the gene therapy, such as putting in hotter spark plugs or adding increased pressure to the cylinders by making the cylinder stroke longer, and putting more additives in our adulterated gas and oil in an attempt to get that stuff to fire better. Why not clean up the gas and the oil? Because we are what we absorb from what we eat and what we do not excrete. If we are absorbing anti-enzyme factors, we're knocking out enzymes that are responsible for all of the activities that we have just referred to on this tape. We should therefore not be taking anti-enzyme factors into our bodies in great high amounts, such as occurs when you're drinking fluoridated water or using fluoridated toothpaste. Fluoride is the strongest anti-enzyme factor known in the world other than acid and fire. In addition, since salt is an anti-enzyme factor, that's why people pickle with it, we should not be eating great buckets of salt and converting our meal to something underneath what looks like a fine snowstorm. We'll now go into aspects of diabetes that are probably not quite as deep. For example, the Ojibwe Indian on Christian Island, which is in Canada, have a 20% incidence of diabetes today. The significant factor is that in these people, diabetes was unknown in the 1920s. In the later 20s, however, the majority of them adopted the Western diet and lifestyle. This involved white flour products, refined products, donuts and pies and desserts loaded with sugar, etc. The Pima Indians in Phoenix, Arizona have the highest incidence of diabetes in the world, and this is the maturity onset type. They've traditionally had a diet extremely high in fat. And although I've incriminated fat, it must be remembered that body acidity is noted among the important factors in becoming a diabetic. Body acidity is a factor that results from a poor food intake. By extracting substances from foods that have been provided for us in the raw. And when we extract them, we run into real problems. An example of a factor that causes body acidity, of course, is some white flour, white sugar. Well, as we've also indicated before, diabetes is a spectrum or a progressive disease that develops over time, particularly where it comes to type 2 diabetes. That spectrum is frequently divided into four parts: the pre-diabetic, which is associated with insulin resistance; latent diabetic, in which case the insulin resistance is going up; the chemical diabetic, in which case we can check that the blood sugars are elevated; and the frank diabetic, when they start to have the physical signs associated with high blood sugar. Pre-diabetes involves a strong family history and having large babies at birth. Almost anyone that has a baby weighing 9 pounds at birth has close to 100% chance of being a diabetic before they're age 70. Overweight is another sign, as we've indicated, and also microangiography, which is really a test indicating what has gone on as far as the changes in minute little blood vessels. Latent diabetes is having very large babies at birth and chronic obesity. Chemical diabetes is where you have cataracts and a bit of peripheral neuritis showing, and that is a pain in the feet, usually made worse by walking. And then there's frank diabetes, having chronically high blood sugar. Okay, we're now going to just carry on with the etiology or cause of diabetes, which we've already referred to. But there are some other aspects. One of them is hereditary. It's more common in Jews. Diabetes is rare in the Chinese. And if the parents are diabetic, approximately 50% of the children will be. Lifestyle, of course, is involved in this, and there may be genetic factors as well. Okay. Number two, age is important. Approximately 50% of diabetics will get it before age 50. The highest incidence being between 50 and 60 years in many studies. And approximately 75% of people who become diabetic will do so before the age of 60. Number three is sex. Not having it, but being it. Slightly more males than females in youth, and more females than males in the older age group. Diabetic females have an increased incidence of cancer of both the breast and the uterus. This is also associated with chronic acidemia that we mentioned before, resulting from eating wrong foods. Junk foods produce acidemia. Okay. Number four in this list of causes is obesity. Greater than 90% of those developing maturity onset diabetes are overweight. Some studies have gone as high as 97% of maturity onset diabetes being overweight. For every 20% excess of body weight, the prevalence of diabetes doubles. Number five is stress. Physical stress, such as infections, especially the staph type or the staph aureus type, can unmask latent diabetes. Incidentally, pregnancy does the same. Well, what will fight staph infections? Well, one of the things that does is the garlic and colloidal silver and oregano oil. I might mention when it comes to colloidal silver that some people make the mistake of staying on it too long. Silver is a carcinogenic if taken over long periods of time. My patients are advised strictly to take it no longer than 3 weeks at a time, and the same applies to echinacea since it can stimulate the immune system and exhaust it, whereas garlic can be taken indefinitely and it doesn't overstimulate the immune system. Another cause of diabetes is insecticide exposure. Here it was a Dr. Martina Jaworski researching at the University of Alberta that made this connection, because we have lots of farmers in the area using insecticides in great numbers. Since 1958, the number of Americans getting diabetes has increased 600%. This closely parallels, get this, the increase in obesity as well. When the doctor sends you for a blood sugar curve, if it is normal, he will note that although the rise differences, or the amount that the blood sugar goes up after you've eaten, varies, the drop is never at any hour too much below the starting point at fasting. There is an exception to this, and that's if you eat mashed potatoes or oatmeal at breakfast, in which case the blood sugar will definitely drop below the original fasting level.